We're thankful that because you see us seated at your right hand, that you give us access into your presence every moment of every day. We don't come because of who we are. There's no worth in and of ourselves to come before you. We have our worth because we are now in Christ, and you see us that we come through him. We're able to come to you. We're able to actually not even just approach you when we have needs, but just to be able to come and to rest there, to find a rest at the throne of grace, a rest from all of our efforts and works to try to be acceptable unto you, and to know that we have been made acceptable because we're in Christ. And we're thankful for that reality. And we continue to remember those that have needs, physical needs, spiritual needs, emotional needs that people are dealing with. You know the heart of each and every one, not only here, but those that aren't with us today. And we're thankful that your Spirit is able to address these things. We ask that you would help us, as always, to be those who are sensitive to those that are around us in such a way that perhaps you might use us in their life today. We're thankful for your word. We're thankful that as we rest at your right hand, that we become those who are teachable. Your Spirit is able to communicate these truths to us, things that are very plain, black and white on the page of your word, that we can actually see that they have value. We can welcome them then, accept them, and avail ourselves of them as we might have opportunity. We think of our sister Terry. She's had to go home because of some of the pain that she has, and we just asked for her doctor appointment tomorrow that they'd be able to pinpoint the cause of these pains and be able to address it. And as we look at your word again, we're thankful for it, thankful for the Spirit who is our teacher. Amen. We are continuing our study on dispensations, looking at these various house rules in God's plan. And we're going to be moving in and looking at the dispensation of conscience. Now, we're not going to be talking a great deal about the conscience today. It's actually going to, we're going to end up getting into that next week. I'm dividing this, our outline. We're only going to get through the first half of this outline today. Hopefully, get through the first half. I make no promises. Because what we're going to share in communion is one of the things, but one of the reasons there's a lot of material here when we're talking about the dispensation of conscience and what is involved in this. But we got a little scenario that plays out here when we move into this dispensation of conscience, and that scenario is going to have to do with an interaction between two brothers. And it's going to address a question that we have about who is the manager, who's the steward of this particular dispensation. And that manager or steward should have been Cain, but Cain relinquished that because Cain did not choose to operate the way God wanted him to. And so he didn't end up getting that full right. And we're also going to see then that the household, unlike our household today, unlike the household of Israel, and unlike the household of Adam and Eve, at this point, the household is going to end up being the whole human race. And it's going to end up being the whole human race, not only for this particular dispensation, but the one that follows. And so we'll develop that a little bit more as we move through this today. So let's look first of all at looking at who's who in this dispensation of conscience. First of all, God is the owner. God is the owner. Okay, and I do need some help on this. And I'm going to ask Clinton to come on up here. And I'm going to ask Clayton to come up here. Okay? I need brothers. I need brothers for this. I could have tried sisters, but I think Clayton and Clinton are going to illustrate this better. Thanks for being a good sport, Clinton. Okay. Sometimes eighth graders don't want to be good sports anymore. I appreciate that. So, okay. First thing I'm going to have you do, let's see, because I watched some of the stuff that your dad has you guys do for exercise at home. So the first thing I want to do is I want to see both of you knock out 10 push-ups.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go. Come on. 10 push-ups.
We need a video of you on live stream.
You guys don't have to see it. I'm playing the role of God here, so. Boy, that was a long time. Nice job, Clinton. Good job. Thank you so much. I liked it. Good form. Boy, you knocked those right out. Good job. You guys can go sit down. What'd you think about that, Clayton? Why'd you shake your head? Why'd you shake your head? You didn't like doing push-ups? Oh, you didn't like doing push-ups. Okay. Anyway, I was trying to illustrate something with those two brothers. Because Cain and Abel, if you take your Bibles and turn over to Genesis chapter 4, Cain and Abel each bring an offering before God. Genesis chapter 4. And if you look at verse 3, Genesis chapter 4 and verse 3, it says, "So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord from the fruit of the ground." That's what he was. He was a farmer. "And Abel, on his part, also brought the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering." Now, I'm going to dispel with something that most of you might not even have a problem with, but this is a problem I had for years. I had this problem until I went to seminary and took Hebrew. Because when it says the fruit of the ground, that word fruit does not necessarily mean an apple or a pear or an orange. It simply means produce. That's all it means. So it could have been grain. It could have been wheat. It could have been barley. It could have been corn. It could have been potato. Yeah, that's all that word para means. Just means fruit of the ground. It doesn't necessarily mean fruit, but because our Bibles translate that fruit. Ever since I was a kid, I always pictured he had a pile of fruit laying on top of there, apples and oranges. Really, really neither here nor there in the larger scheme of things, but he's a farmer, and so he brings the produce of whatever he farms. Could have been material, could have been fruit from an orchard, could have been grain. Abel, however, is a tender of flocks, and he brings something. What it actually says is the firstlings of his flock. He doesn't look through his flock. And remember, this was very important for Israel down the road when God gave them very clear delineation on how they were supposed to bring sacrifices. But he didn't look over his flock and go, "That one over there is kind of stumbles around. He's got like a really bum leg there. And I can see that he's developing a sore over here. And that lamb is not going to last very long. So let's sacrifice him anyway." He looks over there and he's looking going, "That's a really good strong lamb." Now, if you've ever bred livestock or had livestock, those are the ones you want to keep, right? Because those are the ones you're saying, "Well, that's a healthy lamb. That potentially is going to help create a healthy bloodline. And so I'm going to hopefully get other healthy ones from that one." But see, that's what God asked for. He asks for the firstling of this. And so it tells us here that that's what Cain brings of that. And then it says in verse 4, "And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering." Now that word regard, I tried to indicate this. I'm going to ask Clayton if he can tell me something. When you guys got done doing your push-ups, what did I do when you were done? You remember what I did? What did I do for Clinton?
Good job.
I told him good job. Did I tell you good job? Did that make you feel bad? Nah, okay, you're a good sport, okay. Some people would feel bad, you know. I was trying to come up with a good illustration here where, you know, one of them would be like, "Well," because that's what happens with Cain and Abel here. And one of the interesting things is they both bring this offering, and this word regard in the Hebrew is simply the word meaning to look at. Now remember, when God was interacting with these people, it's not that there's kind of some mystical glowing thing out of Star Trek up here that's kind of floating in the sky. Woo! God, you know. It's actually God. We have this so many times throughout the book of Genesis, and actually even into some of the history of Israel down the road, that when God comes down, God appeared in a human form. It was only temporary, but he'd come down and he'd look something like them. Whether he looked exactly like they looked, I don't know. But he would come down. And so you've got Cain with his offering over here, and you've got Abel with his offering over here, and God comes down. And could you imagine what this is like for two brothers? And God shows up, and God does this. Walks over. Now in our modern setting, if it were me, you know, I'd be going, you know, I don't think God probably did that for Cain, or for Abel, excuse me, but he does that. And then he gets done, and he leaves. Maybe talks more with them. But what did he not do? He never went over and looked at Cain's. And it tells us that in verse 5, "But for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard." And again, that word regard in the New American Standard is simply a word meaning to look at. He didn't look at Cain's. God doesn't have to look at it and go, "Is it any good?" He's an all-knowing God. He knows whether it's good or not. So by looking at it, he's showing approval. I approve of yours. I will come and look at yours. I tried to do that with Clinton and Clayton. I shook Clinton's hand and said, nice form. He did. He had really good form when he was doing his push-ups. Clayton, on the other hand, he's doing that what do you call that, when you round your back and you're not supposed to do that. He's doing this thing and he's just kind of tipping the head down like that. The way he's doing it, form, not so good. So I'm not going to say anything about that. That's okay. I'm just using it as an example here. And so that's this difference here between these two. Now, I do want to add one other detail in here that we're not going to actually get to. I'm just trying to make sure on my outline here. We're not going to actually get to this until next week, but I just want to throw this in here. Keep your finger here for a moment and flip over to the book of Hebrews in chapter 11. Now, in Hebrews chapter 11, we're going to come back over this next week, but I just need to fill this in so you kind of understand a little something that goes on here between Cain and Abel. Were these two guys just kind of guessing at, well, maybe I'll do this or maybe I'll do that. Maybe I should give an offering to God. They just kind of invent this thing. Or is there potentially a precedent set? And we actually have something very important for us in Hebrews chapter 11, where he is giving here an outline of people who have demonstrated faith in their conduct. Now, faith always requires what? What's one of the first things that you have to have if you're going to have faith? You have to have a promise from God. A lot of times what we call faith in Christendom is frequently presumption. I presume that this is the way it should be. And so therefore I have faith in what I presume to be the case. But I actually have no specific promise from God. And so for me to have a promise from God indicates that God has had to say something to me. And so when we look here in verse 4 of Hebrews 11, it says, by faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain. Now, why could you say that it's a better sacrifice? Because he did it by faith, which meant that he had to have some promise from God that he could direct faith. He had to direct faith at this promise. And the thing is these New Testament Christians didn't need that delineated for them because they knew from what Paul is explaining to them what faith was, that faith was always in some promise, some specific revelation from God. It wasn't just that I make something up and say, well, I think this from God, therefore I have faith in that. That's not the case. It goes on. I'm going to read the whole verse again. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous. Here's the second issue in here. Abel was righteous. I get these brothers straight. Cain was not, by what he's saying. God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. But the importance of this passage is it's indicating that they actually had some sort of a promise from God. Therefore, when Cain and Abel came, Abel put faith in that promise and brought an offering in keeping with that, and Cain did not. Very simple. Okay. So, God is the owner because God's the one that actually looked at Cain and Abel's offerings. He is also the one that after this is all done, we're going to look at this in a little more detail in a minute. He's also the one that addresses Cain after the problem. And he's the one that set limits of man's time when man disobeyed. And we can look at that very quickly over in Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6, he's the one that sets the time limit here. We have in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 3, and the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. People from Peggy's Sunday school class today, what did 120 years mean? You want to try it, Elizabeth? You were looking up. What did 120 years mean? Do you remember? Okay, that was how long until God was going to punish the people. And in that time, what was Noah going to be doing? He was going to be building an ark. Okay, it's kind of interesting. Our lesson today and Peggy's lesson kind of meet together. Now, Cain would have been the manager. He would have been the steward in this dispensation. And it tells us, if you look here in Genesis chapter 6, Genesis chapter 4, pardon me, when this is all done, let's look at this encounter that takes place. Verse 5, and it says, "For Cain and for his offering, he had no regard," or "he did not look. And so Cain became very angry and his countenance fell." Again, I always like the way our English Bibles translate these words, because the word countenance is his face. It's kind of like they're going back there, and what was Clayton doing? Well, that's what Cain's doing. Cain's not doing this, but Cain's going, he's showing something by his face. Literally, the word means his face was down. I think of a kid that's pouting. Adults never do that, right? Well, Cain, I don't know how old he was when this happened, but Cain's face is down. He is upset that God did not look at his sacrifice. And so it says his face was down, his countenance was down. And the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face fallen? If you would do well, will not then your..." You, and notice it says, "will not your countenance," if you have a New American Standard. There's no word countenance there. In fact, I think I left it in here because I just took this out of New American Standard. It says, "and his countenance fell." And the Lord said, "Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen?" Let's move on, I think, to the, hopefully we have it in the next verse. Verse 7. Okay. And it says, "it is not if you do well," and it just says to lift up. It doesn't say lift up your countenance. And the New American Standard is at least fair that they put those words in italics. But this word that is translated to do or to lift up, sha'af, from a word in Hebrew. I always remember this Hebrew word because we get it from NASA. And what did NASA do? They lifted rockets into space. That's why you're learning foreign vocabulary, so to lift up anyway. But it comes from that. But it has this idea of that which is lifted up. Now, maybe to help us understand a little bit about what that means. Oh, I'm jumping ahead of myself. I guess I don't have that in here. The lifting up has to do with Cain's position, is what he's talking about here with this word, to exalt. And so he would have had this position. He would have, if he would have done the right thing, he could have been lifted up. Not his countenance, not his face, that's not the point. He himself would have been lifted up. We will come back to this verse in a little while. So, this is a verse that we have to kind of take some time with, because our English Bibles, and I'm going to just be very honest with you. I don't own a ton of commentaries on Genesis, but I own several, and none of them agree with this point of view, although I did find one that points, or one of my theology books that points this view out, and he favors this, and he explains why. Okay, my view, my understanding here of Genesis chapter 4 and what he tells him in verse 7 is, if you would do well, if you would do good, Cain, do the thing that would provide for real well-being in here, in this matter, it says, you will be exalted, would be the idea, and if you do not do well, and that's the situation where this is, then our Bibles, this is where New American Standard translates, sin is crouching at your door. And almost every commentary I have on Genesis, actually I shouldn't say almost, every commentary I have on Genesis always looks at sin as like an animal of prey that's crouching at his door, ready to pounce on Cain. The problem with that is, the word for crouch does not mean to crouch as though you're ready to pounce. It is always used of animals that are lying down at rest. Okay? So that's one of the things that we have in here. Second of all, we also have that he says sin is crouching at your door. But the word that's translated sin is, in the Hebrew, translated both sin as well as sin offering. We're going to look at that in just a little bit. And finally, the last thing he would do is that as a result of this, he, Cain, would rule over him. Now, who's the him in this context? Not sin. He's not ruling over sin. He's going to end up, he would end up ruling over his brother. He would have the position he was supposed to have. That shouldn't really surprise us a whole lot, because normally the firstborn was supposed to have the position of preeminence. But through much of the Old Testament history, it's not the firstborn that ends up getting the preeminent position, because God ends up deciding or choosing otherwise. So just a quick review of what Genesis 4:7 is saying. He says, Cain, if you do the right thing, If you do this, things would go well. You'd be exalted. You'd have this. If you don't choose to operate well, you don't choose to do the thing that would bring real well-being. And this is going to tie in with conscience, which we're going to look at next week. Because your conscience, in very simple terms, is where you are balancing what you know with your conduct. And you're trying to maintain a sense of well-being. You want to come out of the situation feeling well, to feel good about it. And that's why he chooses the word good in here that is translated, if you would do well. It's actually a verb form of the word tov that we have up here. There it is. And we have it again in the second line of this verse. And so really we're talking about what you're doing under conscience. You're trying to maintain a sense of well-being by doing the good thing. And if he doesn't do that, then God has actually provided, made possible a sin offering that he could address the sin issue right there. He could address that. And if he would address that sin offering, take that thing, then he would actually be able to go on and do what? Rule over his brother, which is what he was supposed to be doing. Okay. So let's look first at the example of the sin offering. Just to show you this, turn with me to Exodus 29. Just trying to show you a couple of examples. You could look at a lot more of these if you went home and pulled this word. You'd find out places where it definitely refers to sin or an act of sin, but you're also going to find places in which it refers to a sin offering. So in Exodus chapter 29, verse 17, and he says, "And then you shall cut the ram into its pieces and wash its entrails and its legs and put them with its pieces and its head." Am I in 29:17? In my Bible, I'm not. Oh. Huh. Okay. I've messed something up on this because I do not have the. I'm not in the right. Exodus 29:14. It's not 17. I've got 17 up here. I need to read my notes. Pardon me. Look at verse 14. There's the one we want. It says, "But the flesh of the bull and its hide and its refuse you shall burn with fire outside the camp. It is a sin offering." Now, I didn't bring the Hebrew up here, except simply to say that this is all you have in Hebrew, and this is down low. Ben and I were talking about this. Sometimes you don't see this. But you can see that we have the same, even if you can't read Hebrew, you can see that the same chicken that walked here, and so we have literally, it's here, it, and sin offering, or sin. The word offering isn't actually part of the word. Almost all the time when you read sin offering English, it's simply translating the word kata, sin. There's not a special word added offering in almost every case of this. And so this is just one example here, just trying to show you that we have exact, and that is, that right out of the Hebrew text, that's the exact, that's not just the form I'm putting up there, that actually is the same exact form in both cases that we have in both situations. Now, and I've given you some other verses you can look at. Now let's look at that word crouch that's used there and turn to Genesis chapter 29. Genesis chapter 29. Genesis 29 and verse 2. This is when Jacob has been sent up north, and he's going to end up meeting his wife, Rachel. And so it says, "Then Jacob went on his journey," verse 1, "and came to the land of the sons of the east," verse 2, "and he looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were," what does it say there? "Were lying there." And we're not going to go through the rest of the verse. But it's that word lying there. Now, three flocks of sheep. I don't normally think of sheep as particularly aggressive animals, okay? My grandma had an uncle, Uncle Art, that when I was a kid, he raised sheep. He did have a ram. The ram was aggressive. He used to scare me when you'd walk by his pen in the barn because he'd stomp and snort and charge at the pen gate and slam into it. He was kind of naughty. He actually had hit Uncle Art a couple of different times when Uncle Art forgot that he was in a certain pen. Anyway. But most sheep are not of themselves aggressive. Usually think of sheep as fairly docile animals in this regard. And so he says these are lying down here. And again, just to review this for myself, I went through every place where this word crouching occurs in the Old Testament, and it's always used just of animals lying down at rest, never getting ready, crouching, ready to pounce. Okay? most of us don't get to see, well, unless maybe you're watching videos on predators hunting, right? Didn't quite say you guys got to watch those sometime down at the Keys. And I watch a neighborhood cat that goes down here, and I watch him when it's crouching and it's hunting through the weeds down here. Very different stance than looking at somebody's cat that's sprawled out. I think Ronnie put a picture of one of their cats sprawled out on the floor. That cat's not pouncing on anything recently. And it's just, you know, that's a very different picture idea. In fact, if you look in Genesis 49, and I think this is very important because one person pointed this verse out of here's a predator getting ready to pounce, but it's absolutely the opposite. If you just read the verse, it's talking about Judah, and it says in verse 9, Judah is a lion's whelp. Well, if we just stop there, we go, okay, well, maybe he is getting ready to pounce, but notice what it says. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. See, this creature, this lion, has already taken prey. He's done with that. He's not hunting. He couches. Is there a difference between crouching and couching? Couching is relaxing. It's laying down. It's stretching out on a couch. He couches. He lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? See, he's resting. This is a lion at rest. He said, don't go in and stir him up. He's at rest. So even here's an animal, a predator, but he's not hunting. He's just at rest. And there's only one other place that I came across over in the book of Isaiah where you also have a predator. And the whole point is the predator is not hunting in that passage. Again, that's one where the predator is lying down with the prey at rest. If you make him a predator preying on the animal, you're destroying the whole image in that passage in Isaiah. Okay, so, and you can, I think I have that written there in Isaiah 11. It's a very popular passage on the kingdom that we use. So, when it's talking about this in Genesis chapter 4, that he says that there is a sin offering, I think is a legitimate way to translate this, and it is resting like a beast of the field, which is the meaning of the word primarily, that he's talking about, he says that there's a sin offering at your door. Cain, you can deal with this. You can handle this situation properly. And then as a result of that, if you're still there in Genesis chapter 49, you can see an example there where he refers to the eldest son, Reuben, and we have the word to lift up. And so if you look in, verse 3, right? It says, and Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength. Preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. And so he looks at him. It's actually the word dignity that's used there. Lifted up or preeminent in your being lifted up or your lifted upness, your exalted state is the idea here. And this is what he's talking about. He's not talking about lifting your face up. He's talking about you personally being elevated, lifted up, like Reuben, the firstborn, was being lifted up, having this preeminent position in the family, which is what the firstborn was supposed to have. So Cain could have been the manager. He could have been lifted up. He could have offered the sacrifice that was at his door. He could have ruled over his brother. In other words, he could have done the right thing. Okay, in very simple terms. But if you look back in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 8, now this is very interesting because as Peg was studying these things, she and I had quite a conversation about this week because of the way... Did your English Bible handle these words a little bit differently, or was it just the Sunday school lesson material? Sunday school material kind of didn't represent this well. If you look here in verse 8, okay, so in verse 8, then it says, and Cain then spoke to his brother Abel. In other words, God just told him, you can be lifted up, you can do the right thing. And so Cain goes and talks with his brother Abel. Very plain in the Hebrew. It's like one of the first vocabulary words you learn, one of the first verbs you learn in Hebrew is the verb amer, to speak with. It's just talking. So he speaks with his brother Abel. And the material that Peggy had, that she was in, didn't really represent that idea. They looked at it as though Cain just went out and killed his brother. But the whole thing is, so he's saying, you know what? God told me I can rule over you. It's like, isn't this the way you see two brothers do that thing, you know? I didn't have brothers, so. But I had a sister, and we kind of competed back and forth, you know. And so sometimes you were like, you know, hey, mom says I'm the boss. Well, they're gone tonight. I'm the one that's in charge. Like that ever meant anything to her, you know. But you can see Cain and Abel, and you could see Cain going out there and saying, God says I'm going to rule over you. And probably Abel, because he's righteous from what we read in Hebrews 11, probably doesn't go, oh, no, you're not. But very likely, however Abel does respond, it just kind of irks Cain even more. Have you ever noticed sometimes that when a person that's doing the right thing and another person's trying to egg them on, and this person doesn't really give them anything to respond to, they just continue the right thing, that sometimes it really can just... Sometimes it calms this person, but also sometimes it has the effect of making this person even feel more guilty, more frustrated with the way they're acting. And so as a result of that, it says, and Cain then, verse 8, told his brother Abel, or spoke with his brother Abel, and then it adds in the Hebrew, and it came about, it came to be that while they were in the field, so this didn't happen, he talks with them, and then immediately this other thing happens. It's as though this thing's stewing with Cain for a while, and it says, and it came about, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Now, because we've got a really distorted view of history, we think of these guys walking around like cavemen out there in kind of rough, cruddy animal skin kind of draped over them like grog. And so Cain's like, oh, I don't like my brother. Pick up rock, hit you on head. You know, seriously, I mean, this is the kind of stuff I used to see in Bible books, which really are, those were Bible books for kids that were really being written somewhat from an evolutionary view of human history. You know, as though we're all advanced and these people were all dummies. These people were probably way smarter than us. Yeah, maybe they didn't drive cars and fly airplanes, but that didn't mean they weren't intelligent. And probably more so than us. We're on the down end stream of the gene pool here. We've got 6,000 years of destruction to the gene pool, and it's not showing itself to get any better. Anyway, turn with me over to 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3, because it explains what Cain does. I think you can put it together if you just read Genesis, but John makes it really clear for New Testament readers. John's writing to people that probably don't read Hebrew, and as a result, they probably don't know the story really well over there. And so he makes a statement in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 12. Let's go to verse 11. For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Not like Cain, who was from the evil one. Well, that's telling you that Satan actually has an influence. You would never get that specifically out of the context of Genesis chapter 4, excuse me. But John fills this detail in. And he slew his brother. And the word slew, the Greek word that's used here, is the Greek word sphazo, which was a word that meant to slaughter by slitting the throat, which is what they did for sacrifices. The emphasis, if you put this together with the account that goes on in Genesis chapter 4, that God is telling Cain, hey, Cain, you don't do well, there is a sin offering that's crouched at your door. You can do the right thing. And Cain goes and tells his brother, you know what? God says, I can rule over you. And Cain, and maybe Abel goes, hey, good, do the right thing. Cain goes home, stews about it. They go out there, happen to be out in the field. Cain gets upset and he goes, fine. Reaches in his belt, pulls out his knife, grabs his brother's head, and there, God, there's your sacrifice. Because that's what he's doing. God offered him an alternative. He offered him a sin offering at his door, and Cain gave God a blood sacrifice. He gave him his brother. If you put these texts together, you get this picture that this is the way Cain reacts. This is, however, why Cain does not end up becoming the steward of this dispensation. He relinquishes his privilege, the opportunity that he could have had to do this, by on every turn, choosing to not do what God wants. We're going to have to come back next week and look at how that develops from Cain, how civilization develops, as we understand civilization, how it develops from Cain's progeny. But we'll come back and look at that next week. The last thing to look at then this morning here is that the household is the whole human race. It's not just Adam's family. Well, they are all Adam's family, aren't they? Because the whole human race is Adam's family in one way or another. But this was the situation. And I want you to turn over to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6, and Peggy and I were even talking about this. The first thing, when she comes out to greet me when I'm eating breakfast this morning, this is the first thing she says. So, and she's been out there thinking through her lesson again, and she comes out into the living room.
When you wake up at 4 o'clock, you gotta think of something.
There you go. So over here in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5, it says, "And the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of his thoughts... of his heart, or every imagination or thing that he plans here, of his thoughts, of his heart, was only evil continually." Or the way a Hebrew said continually is in the Hebrew, they said all day. That's the expression continually in the Hebrew, is just all day. In other words, they spent all their time thinking of evil. Now we're going to talk about what that evil is. When I was a kid, some of you maybe know what these were, but we used to get these things called Chick Tracks. We had a pastor that liked these, and they were little comic books like this, little black and white comic books that maybe had a little red color in them. And this guy in California would draw these. And you learn some, the gospel was in there, but you got a lot of bad theology mixed in with some of these. And I remember several times when you would always see these, I always would say, oh, I'm glad I didn't live in the days before the flood. Because you'd see people, and you'd see guys hanging out with loose women drinking beer, and you'd see guys in the background with knives stabbing their brothers. And those were the pictures he drew, because that's what his idea. But we're going to talk next week. That's probably not largely what he means by evil all the day. It had to do with what they put a value on. And they did not put a value on God. They put a value on something else. But you have to come back next week for that. Same time, same channel. Then we'll look at what that thing was that they put a high value on. And it's actually very plain in the text what they put a high value on. We'll come back and we will pick that up next week. And all of this then comes together with understanding the problem of the conscience. See, man has a conscience. After Adam and Eve eat the fruit, what do they now have the ability to know? Good and evil. And what is good and evil? We've been over this. Good means that which would cause contentment and well-being, and evil is that which...
Wait. My Sunday school class.
Okay, Peggy's Sunday school class, somebody from there. Kale. The girls have already answered. Kale, what would evil be then? Or Asher?
Disaster.
Okay. Yeah, those are the two ideas of tov and ra, that which brings a sense of well-being, that which brings disaster. And man plans only disaster for himself in this. He cannot with his conscience actually bring about what really brings about a true sense of well-being. And we'll come back and we will look at that next week. Yes, that's going to be an expression of that. Yes, Ben, I had to think about that for just a little bit, what you were saying. So,